Okay. So let us continue again as where we left off yesterday. And as I mentioned, we're going to have a closer look at some of these defilements and how to overcome them and how to deal with them. And that is what we're going to do now. And I'm going to start with the problem of sensual pleasures or sensory desires might be a better translation. I'm going to start with that because it is the most profound of the defilements and quite hard to overcome because the sensory world often seems so pleasant, it seems so delightful, and because of that it can be hard to see the downside. So this particular sutta, the Potalya Sutta, is going to look at the downsides in a very general way. It's not really going to be about individual desires that can be used for that as well. But when it comes to individual desires, it's often better to use the method we were talking about yesterday, about understanding the cause for those desires. The subha nimitta, seeing the beautiful in things, is often the immediate way to deal with that, to remind yourself of the negative, whereas these are more like broad outlooks, but they will aid you in using, in also overcoming particular instances of these kind of desires. But these are more ways of reflecting. The idea is not that as soon as you read this, you have to chuck out all sensory pleasure. That would be the wrong way to take it. It is more like just a way of reflection. And then the response is pretty much supposed to be automatic. Yeah. Once you read this, there will be an understanding, presumably. And once there is an understanding, there will be an automatic kind of distancing or reduction in interest. And as you do this over time, the reduction will continue and then you build up the spiritual path instead. That is kind of the idea behind this. So it's not so much a program for action, it's more like a program for reflection and seeing things from the way of the Buddha, the way he thinks about things. First of all, I want to have a quick look at this little sutta called the Tapusa Sutta. This is from the numerical discourses of the Buddha, the Anguttara Nikaya 9s. This talks about the Buddha. He's talking here about why he wasn't able to achieve samadhi. And surprise, surprise, the reason was because of too much interest in that world, the sensory world. So this is how this little sutta goes, kind of sets up the reason why we want to look at the sensual pleasures in a minute. Before my awakening, while I was just a bodhisattva, it not yet fully awakened, it occurred to me too. Good is renunciation. Good is solitude. Yet my mind did not launch out upon renunciation and become placid, settled, and liberated in it, though I saw it as peaceful. It occurred to me, why is it that my mind does not launch out upon renunciation and become placid, settled, and liberated in it, though I see it as peaceful? Then it occurred to me, I have not seen the danger in sensual pleasures, and I have not cultivated that insight. I have not achieved the benefit of renunciation, and have not pursued it. Therefore my mind does not launch out upon renunciation, and become placid and settled and liberated in it, though I see it as peaceful. So here, basically this tells you one of the main reasons why you can't achieve samadhi, the idea here of the mind launching out, becoming placid, settled, and liberated in that idea of pursuing the danger in sensual pleasures, that basically is a standard way of talking about attaining samadhi, in particular things like the jhana states. So what he's saying here is this lack of insight into sensual pleasure that is the main problem, why he can't go any deeper. This is what is holding him back. And you will see here, he says specifically that it is about not seeing the danger and not cultivating that insight. All of these things need to be cultivated. It takes time for these things to ripen, for them to become powerful in the mind, to become really useful, to counteract the problems. So you have to do this again and again, and as you do it again and again, and gradually it kind of becomes a force in your mind. in one sense, so many of these teachings of the Buddha are so obvious in so many ways. It kind of makes sense straight away. But even though it makes sense straight away, it doesn't really mean you have taken it on board in a deep sense. Those are two different things. It's actually good that these teachings tend to make sense straight away, because it means that at least we have an initial acceptance of these things. But to really allow these things to sink in deep and become a powerful asset, if you like, or a powerful force in the meditation, you have to kind of bring it back to mind many, many times, and then gradually it kind of starts to become obvious why this is a problem. It's as if you're seeing the same thing from different angles. This is why I like to often read out the same suttas every year. You can imagine, you think that you might get these suttas every year, and it's a lot, but actually I do this kind of retreats quite regularly now, many different countries around the world, and I still enjoy it, even though I read these things out like 5 or 6 times a year, or once a month sometimes, kind of one after the other. But it's still enjoyable, because and the reason why it is enjoyable, because you realize there is a truth there, and gradually it's like you're boring into that truth, going deeper into it, and allowing it to sink into the mind, and then it becomes really more and more enjoyable, more and more powerful, more and more useful as a consequence. And this is what the Buddha to be is saying here. Based on that, just very briefly, this is before, you can see the Buddha talks about before his awakening, while he was only a bodhisattva. So here, the word bodhisattva occurs a few times in the suttas, and it really, in the suttas, it refers to the Buddha to be after he left the household life, before he reached awakening. Occasionally in the suttas it is used in a broader sense than that, but that is by far the most important one. And the broader senses, in my opinion, seem to be later, like in the Acharya Abhuta Sutta, the Sutta on the Wonderful and Marvelous, where the Buddha talks about all the amazing qualities when he was born. That sutta has many late elements to it, and so there the idea of bodhisattva is perhaps not as original, but generally speaking it refers to the Buddha to be after his going forth and before his awakening. And this is a very different usage from how the word bodhisattva is used in the, for example, the Mahayana suttas, or later Pali literature, where it refers to this person who is traveling around samsara for 4 incalculable eons, trying to purify himself, to make himself, or sometimes even female reincarnations as well. There is some evidence that there were supposed to have been female reincarnations of the bodhisattva, and eventually then becoming the Buddha down the track. That's a much later development. The early suttas, this is what it means. Interesting also that the word bodhisattva, it is quite possible that it is derived from the Sanskrit, or related to the Sanskrit word bodhisatta, not bodhisattva as it's normally taken to be. And bodhisatta means someone who is intent on awakening here. Makes good sense. Yeah, you are intent on awakening, you go forth from the household life, you are intent on it, and then you achieve it as a result. That was a suggestion by Professor Richard Gombrich, who is the ex-professor of Sanskrit at Oxford University. So he's one of the greatest authorities of Sanskrit, usually considered, in the world, pretty much. That doesn't mean that he always gets it right, but it means that usually it is fairly well considered. Okay. Then, Ananda, it occurred to me, if, having seen the danger in sensual pleasures, or the desire for the objects of the world, of the sensual world, I would cultivate that insight, and if, having achieved the benefit of renunciation, I would pursue it, it is then possible that my mind would launch out upon renunciation and become placid, settled, and liberated in it, since I see it as peaceful. Sometimes later, having seen the danger in sensual pleasures, I cultivated that insight, and having achieved the benefit of renunciation, I pursued it. My mind then launched out upon renunciation, and became placid, settled, and liberated in it, since I saw it as peaceful. So that gives you the reason why we pursue this kind of insights, because it allows you to enter the samadhi. And this is what happens to the Buddha himself before his awakening experience. Now we come to the Potalia Sutta, found in the Middling Sayings, number 54. And seven similes on the danger of sensory pleasures. The word in Pali that we translate as, or that Bhikkhu Bodhi here translates as sensual pleasures, is the word kama. It is not to be confused with the word kamma. Kamma is one word, kama is another word. There's a slight different in pronunciation that is often missed by people who don't have an Indian background. And the kamma is a double M, and it's pronounced as if kamma, twice. Kama is a long A sound, and it's different. So one of these kamma, it means action, and that is the kind of like the law of kamma or karma in Sanskrit. And kama is to do with this sensuality. Now the word kama has two meanings in the Pali canon, and the main meaning usually is actually the objects of the world, that entire sensory world around us, the world that we are immersed in at all times, the sights we hear, the sounds that we the sights that we see, the sounds that we hear, the things that we touch, everything in the five sense world, all the objects of that world. That is the most common meaning of this word. That may not be obvious when you hear the word sensual pleasure, but that is actually what it is. And then there's the other side, which occurs only occasionally, and that is the desire. The desire for the objects of that world. So these are the two sides of karma, and both of those need to be kept in mind when you read these similes, because they only really make sense once you understand these two sides. Usually we think about karma as desire, but actually it is more like the objects of that world, which become the objects of desire. So, the first of these similes, a householder. This is the Buddha speaking. He's talking to Potalia. He calls him householder. Householder, suppose a dog overcome by hunger and weakness was waiting by a butcher's shop. Then a skilled butcher or his apprentice would toss the dog a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood. What do you think, householder? Would that dog get rid of its hunger and weakness by gnawing such a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because that was a skeleton of well-hacked, clean-hacked, meatless bones smeared with blood. Eventually that dog would reap weariness and disappointment. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a skeleton by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So this is the kind of Buddha's outlook, that sensual pleasures are much suffering and much despair. There's a lot of danger in them. And this particular simile, you have this idea of the dog that goes to the butcher shop, and the dog is hungry, and because it is hungry, it is full of craving, sitting outside, it wants to eat, and full of craving, waiting outside, looking into the windows of this butcher shop. Actually, maybe there were no windows in those, I'm not sure, whatever. And anyway, probably smelling the meat inside or whatever. And then, of course, the butcher inside, he's not going to give away any meat to a dog. The meat is valuable, and especially in ancient India, probably very valuable. So he's going to take everything off that he can. And when there's nothing more to come off those bones, then he might have a slight smidgen of compassion for that dog. And then he throws it out to that dog, a mangy Indian dog. Some of these dogs in some countries are very different from the kind of the lap dogs and the kind of pet dogs that we have sometimes in the Western culture. I don't know if you've been to India, if you've seen some of these dogs. Jeepers, they're pretty miserable creatures, those dogs. Anyway, so it's kind of, and then not only is it miserable, but then it doesn't even get any sustenance. It sits there, it gets this bone, and kind of tastes this bone, licks it a little bit, get a feeling for what meat might taste like, because you get a taste of the blood on that bone, but no satisfaction, craving is just as strong as before. No satisfaction, no contentment, no sense that you have actually achieved anything at all, really. You haven't achieved any goal, any purpose. So the dog is just as hungry, just as miserable as it was before, and runs off to the next butcher shop, again hoping that he will find a butcher that actually will give away meat. But in all of India, there's not a single butcher that will give away meat to dogs, because this is what Indian butchers are like. In fact, any butcher anywhere in the world is not going to throw out meat to dogs. In this simile, there might actually, in reality, there might be butchers that might do this, but in this simile, there is no butcher anywhere who would do that. These butchers are all kind of greedy for money or whatever. So the dog carries on to the next butcher, and on and on and on, always getting the same problem, never finding any satisfaction. And then one day the dog dies. When the dog dies, it gets reborn as a little puppy, and it learns from his mummy to run to the butcher shop, and then it learns that same trick again, and exactly the same thing, carrying on from life to life, never learning the lessons, because a dog is incapable of learning the lessons. It just carries on kind of automatic fashion, handing down the same silly ideas from one dog generation to the next dog generation. And this is the problem of samsara in this particular simile here. Because in the large parts, we are just like these dogs. This is how kind of we run around searching for things in that sensory world, trying to find satisfaction in the sensory world. When after a while, we should really know better. But we can't. Why? Because we are programmed by the programming of samsara. Samsara has made us into people, conditioned us in such a way that we believe that we're going to find satisfaction and contentment in that world, when actually it is impossible. Why is it impossible? And it is impossible because the problem that we have, the reason we don't feel content, it is a psychological problem. It is a lack of feeling fulfilled psychologically. And we are trying to fill that lack of contentment, that lack of completion, with external things. And sometimes they give a little bit of satisfaction for a very short time. But of course, ultimately, because we haven't changed our mind, because we haven't changed our psychology, that sense of being incomplete is going to come back again. External things can never give you, finally, that sense of completion inside, because it is a psychological problem at root, and you have to solve it in a psychological way, not through external things. So after a while, we stop running around. We stop trying to think that as long as we have all the right things in life, we're going to be okay, we're going to be satisfied. As long as we find the perfect partner. Perfect partner doesn't exist, by the way. But if we think we find a perfect partner, we have all the right kind of house, we have the right kind of job, the good education, we have a good social standing in society, we have a good career, and we kind of make it all right and everything goes right, then we will be happy. Even if you're able to get all those things, and you won't get all those things, but even if you were able to get them, you still wouldn't be satisfied. That is the weird thing, because craving just carries on. That inner problem, the psychological problem, is still there. An external world can never satisfy that. So after a while, you realize, I'm being like a dog. I'm running from butcher shop to butcher shop. This is crazy. It makes it very stark when you see the simile of a dog. This is essentially what human life is like. No satisfaction can be found. And you start to realize, maybe I should listen to this spiritual genius called the Buddha, who existed 2,500 years ago, because he pointed out that satisfaction can be found, but it has to be solved psychologically rather than through the external world or the five senses. And that is why I think one of the best ways of thinking about Buddhism, thinking about it as a psychology. It really is a psychology. It is learning about the mind, developing the mind, changing the mind, using the mind in wise ways. If it is anything, it is a psychology. So listen to the Buddha. What does he say here? And what he says is that if you want contentment, you have to create it by how you live your life. It is one of those strange things, is that once you start living well and you start doing the right things, you start to experience some happiness and contentment because you live well. That happiness that you experience by living in the right way is of a very different order, of a very different kind from the happiness you get externally, because it actually gives rise to real contentment. It gives rise to a reduction in craving, because there's an immediate happiness there that doesn't depend on always running after external things. It is immediately felt in the present moment. And it gives rise, therefore, because it is internal to you, because it is psychological, it gives rise to immediate contentment and a sense of completion, at least partial completion immediately. So notice that. Notice when you feel some degree of happiness or joy on the Buddhist path. Notice that joy that arises in meditation, how it tends to calm you down and make you more present. How mindfulness always comes together with that joy. The spiritual happiness almost by definition draws you into the present. And because it draws into the present, it overcomes the defilements. It makes you automatically feel more complete, more satisfied. The hole inside of you gets filled in, and you actually start to feel that life is finally having some real purpose and meaning. And then you keep on filling in that gap inside. You keep on living the spiritual life in the right way. Your meditation gradually deepens. This is kind of the ideal way that the spiritual path is supposed to be developed. And if it doesn't work like that, you have to find the causes why it doesn't. And then eventually, as you keep on doing that, there comes a point when your meditation becomes so profound, all craving is gone. All that desire that you had your entire life is actually absent. And you have what is so weird is that you have actually found that goal, that purpose, that aim, the thing that craving was telling you, you will get it if you pursue the craving. You have suddenly found it, but through a very different approach, a very different way of thinking. It's astonishing. It's so strange. It's like you understand that a craving is a con man, or a craving is a con woman, or a con person. Yeah, always telling you will be satisfied when you get these things. And you realize craving was always lying to you. You had to let go of craving. You had to find satisfaction somewhere else. You had to move away from the whole idea of craving. And then you can find that satisfaction. And this is why it feels like the meaning of life. Because the purpose of craving is always to search for the meaning of life. Some goal, some purpose. Now you have found that goal. You have found that purpose. You have found that aim. But by going in, using a different strategy. So it actually starts to feel like you have found exactly the very meaning of life itself. Because suddenly you have no purpose anymore. You have no goals. Craving is gone. When craving is gone, you're fully satisfied, fully complete. There's nothing more to do. And then it feels like here you are. You have found what you were looking for all along. The problem, of course, is that one state of samadhi is not enough. You have to do it again and again, and eventually you have to give rise to insight as well, to finally abolish the whole craving thing, and then it becomes permanent. But even a state of samadhi gives you a taste of the meaning of life. You start to understand why, where true happiness is to be found. And because it feels like you found the answer to the meaning of life, any person who attains samadhi, regardless of what religion they belong to, and sometimes you hear about Christians who have similar kind of experiences, and for them this is it. They also have found the meaning of life. That's why they equate it with God, because that is how it is natural for them to interpret this situation. Or someone in the Hindu teaching, in Hinduism also the idea of samadhi is of course very important, and they interpret as union with Brahma. Very similar kind of thing again, because it gives such a very profound sense of meaning and purpose. So contemplate that simile of the hungry dog, because it is very, very meaningful, and it shows you the basic problem of the search in samsara for final happiness. It doesn't exist in that place, in the sensual realm. You have to start looking somewhere else. That realm is always going to let you down. It is always going to be a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of bones. It's always going to be like that. So you have to find satisfaction somewhere else. Okay. Next one. Householder, suppose a vulture, a heron, or a hawk seized a piece of meat and flew away, And then other vultures, herons and hawk, pursued it, pecked and clawed it. What do you think, householder, if that vulture, heron or hawk does not quickly let go of that piece of meat, wouldn't it incur death or death-like suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a piece of meat by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So here you finally you get that nice thing, yeah? Finally you get that Ferrari or whatever it is, a piece of meat. And you're so happy, yeah, with this sensual object that you have finally acquired. And then you are just like this bird who flies away with that piece of meat. But if you have a piece of meat, if you have acquired something nice, then there are other people also want that same piece of meat. Other birds want the same piece of meat. In the animal realm is ruthless and harsh. And other birds, they fly after you and they try to rip it out of your claws. And if you don't let go of it, well then, you will have been in serious trouble. And you will end up dead yourself, or you will have death-like suffering. It says deadly suffering here. It's a bit strange. Deadly suffering, I prefer death-like suffering as a preferred translation. And this is just to show you, I think, the purpose of the simile is just to show you the competition that we always have over the sensual pleasures in the world, how we always compete over these things. And one of the greatest things that we compete over here is a partner in life. Finding someone we can be with, whoever that might be in your life that is special to you, that you have a special relationship with you, the two of you. And this, of course, partners are not, especially if we have an attractive partner, we tend to get jealous. So finally we find someone who is really nice and really caring and has all the right qualities. But other people also want that partner. And this is the problem. So other people are going to try to lure your partner away from you. And this is why the problem with relationships is always the same. If you finally get the good relationship, then you get afraid of losing that person afterwards. And so it is. And this is kind of the competition of the world. It never makes you feel safe. It never makes you feel completely free of anxiety. Because there's always the potential that that relationship is going to break down. And if it doesn't happen because someone else takes your partner away, then your partner might get sick. They might die. They might no longer like you. They might be fed up with you. If you have found a really nice partner, maybe they're too good for you. And maybe they will go on and find someone else instead. Or maybe you have found an arahant, and after a while they realize, actually, I'm better off living in a cave somewhere instead of being with you. Because it's nice to have an arahant as a partner, Maybe not quite arahant, but somewhere like that, someone very wise. But actually, it may not work out either. So it is always, the sensual world is a world of competition. We always fight over things. We fight over the promotion in the job. We fight over the seat on the bus. Is that right? People do that here in Perth as well. Everyone wants that seat on the bus. And people they're not polite enough. It comes an elderly person comes in and nobody gives up the seat to the elderly person. Is that what happens here? It happens. Actually, sometimes people are really nice. Sometimes people do give up their seat. I shouldn't be too hard on people. People vary a little bit. But competition, wherever you look in the world, there's competition for sensual desires, small and big. And the world economy is only so large, the pie is only so big, there's only so much for each one. And if one person gets a larger piece of the pie, sometimes it means other people will have to get a smaller piece. And this is why we want economic growth, and that's why we despair. The economy is only growing 2% this year. No, that is terrible. The pie is only growing by 2%. It means that I might only get 1% because other people get 3% or whatever it is. And then we kind of despair of these silly things. And I don't know, I always feel kind of rather astonished when I see how much focus we put on economic growth in our society. Our interest in the world is so incredibly one-sided, as if there is real happiness to be found in that world. If we had been much wiser as a population and we understood where real happiness was to be found, we wouldn't care at all about the economy, whether it was going down or up. Okay, we might care a little bit because everyone needs enough to survive, but that would really be it. And then we would focus on all of these other things that are so much more productive of happiness, contentment, peace, harmony, and all of these kind of things. And this is kind of the issue with this one here, is that if you start, instead of looking in the world, always competing with others, and arguing with others, arguing over the inheritance from your parents, arguing with your brothers and sisters of who is going to eat what and play with what toy or whatever it is, instead of all that, you start to look for happiness within. When you look for happiness within, there is no argument anymore, because that happiness is independent of the world outside. It is a happiness that is yours alone, and in fact it leads to harmony, because when you have happiness within, you no longer want to argue with the people of the world. You no longer care so much about all those other things. You want to have my boyfriend or girlfriend? Okay, please take my boyfriend or girlfriend. No problem. I'm happy as things are. Yeah, no problem anymore. Maybe not quite like that, but you know, leading in that direction. And this is the beauty of that happiness within. It has a very different effect on the world outside. It doesn't lead to violence. It doesn't lead to endless competition. Competition is always problematic, because ultimately it leads to winners and losers. And someone is always going to kind of feel bad in that competitive environment. It doesn't lead to violence, to all of these conflict that we have in our society. Instead, it leads to harmony and the opposite. So this is kind of this double benefit there of practicing and pursuing the spiritual path rather than pursuing the worldly things. And I find this is so, one of those things that is so off-putting about the worldly happiness is that they always have to lead to conflict. There is no pursuit of the worldly enjoyments without conflict. Conflict is part and parcel of the pursuit of worldly happiness. As long as you seek for happiness in the sensual realm, there's going to be a degree of conflict there. Isn't that kind of off-putting? It's kind of because I think we believe that it's possible to enjoy the world without conflict, but actually it is impossible. And this is kind of the purpose of this particular simile, to point that out. Okay, next one. Householder, suppose a man took a blazing grass torch and went against the wind. What do you think, householder? If that man does not quickly let go of that blazing grass torch, wouldn't that blazing grass torch burn his hand or his arm or some other part of his body, so he might incur death or death-like suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. The sensual objects of the world have been compared to a grass torch by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So the blazing grass torch here is like the sensual objects of the world. And if you pick up those sensual objects in the wrong way, in other words, you go against the wind, then it is going to hurt you badly, because the embers will blow back on you, and before you know it, you are alight and you are burning, and you have a serious problem because of that. And picking up the sensual objects in the wrong way means picking them up with craving, picking them up with attachment. As soon as you attach to something in the sensual world, you're asking for suffering. Yeah, remember that. As soon as you attach to something, you're saying, may I please suffer in the future. Yeah, and the reason is so obvious. The reason is so obvious because as soon as you attach to something, you know that all of those things will have to go sooner or later. And that is when you have to pay back with interest what you did. Not only do you have to give up the object, but also there will be some degree of suffering in the very giving up itself. So when you pick up the grass torch, do it in the right way. Go with the wind rather than against the wind. And when you go with the wind, you can actually enjoy that sensual object without burning yourself so much. So try instead of attaching too much to the objects of the world, attach a little bit more to the spiritual path instead. And then you will loosen your grip automatically on the things of the sensual world. Because, and the reason for that is because when you find your happiness somewhere else, you reduce the search for happiness in that realm of the sensual pleasures. And the most powerful example of that is when you go into a jhana state, this is mentioned in the suttas, and when you go into a profound state of samadhi, you have fully understood the problem of the sensual world. And because you have fully understood it, and you know that real happiness is not to be found there anymore, then what happens afterwards, when you come out of that state of jhana, and you then enjoy some sensual object, this is actually what it says in the suttas, it's quite interesting. You get some simple meal, you get some simple robes to wear as a monastic, you have a simple lodging or whatever it is, and it actually is more delightful. It gives you more happiness, yeah, than you have ever had before. Which is kind of counterintuitive. You have given up when you give up the craving for these things, when you give up the attachment to them, you're actually able to enjoy them more than you did before. And part of the reason is precisely because you don't crave. So if you don't crave, you are more present, your mind is more pure, and you're actually able to enjoy the sensual world more as a consequence. But you don't attach to it. You don't attach to it because you know that there is a higher happiness to be had. And that is the happiness of samadhi or the happiness of insight that comes on the path. So it's really counterintuitive. You everything becomes better when you kind of move up into this hierarchy because your mind is more pure, more mindfulness, more ability to enjoy even the simple pleasures of life. So this shows you the danger of attachment. This is kind of the idea here, I think, with this blazing grass torch, holding on to it in the wrong way. And so you have to hold on to it in the right way, and then it is better. Remember that it is impossible to give up attachment just like that. You can't just say, I'm not going to be attached anymore. Okay, good, so that's it. That's the end of attachment. It doesn't work like that. You have no choice but to attach to some extent. And I mentioned this before about the sense of self. As long as there is a sense of self, attachment will always be there as part and parcel of that sense of self. So that's not really the point. The point here, especially early on in the path, is to shift your attachments a little bit. Move your attachments to a place where they are more useful. Attach a little bit more to the spiritual life. Attach a little bit to the Buddhist teachings. Yeah. If you attach a little bit to these things, it means you will have more interest in them. You will read the suttas a bit more. You will listen to talks about the suttas. And you will attach a little bit to morality and to generosity and all of these things. It is good. Yeah, this is kind of a temporary attachment that ultimately leads to the end of all attachment. So you have to, because attachment has to be there, we just have to shift our focus a little bit. We have to climb that ladder, and we have to grasp a higher rung on the ladder. But you have to hold on, because you haven't got to the top yet. So you have to hold on to the rungs in the meantime. A little bit of attachment is required as you do that. And then you can let go. You can lift your foot from the lower rungs, and you can move up that spiritual ladder stage by stage, following the Noble Eightfold Path and the gradual training here. Okay, let's go on to the next one here. Householder, suppose there were a charcoal pit deeper than a man's height, full of glowing coals without flame or smoke. Then a man came who wanted to live and not to die, who wanted pleasure and recoiled from pain. And two strong men seized him by both arms and dragged him towards that charcoal pit. What do you think, householder? Would that man twist his body this way and that? Yes, venerable sir. Why is that? Because he knows that if he falls into that charcoal pit, he will incur death or death-like suffering because of that. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a charcoal pit by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. This is one of the most kind of amazing similes. Sensual pleasures are like a charcoal pit. It's kind of, this is the one that is most difficult to get your head around, probably. Sometimes when it's difficult to get your head around things, you have to kind of think about it a bit more deeply to see whether there might be some truth to this after all. One of the First things to do is to look at the suttas to see whether there are other places that actually give an explanation of what is going on here, and there is. And if you want to read that explanation, it is found in the Magandhya Sutta, Middle Length Sayings number 75. It's a very nice sutta on the dangers of sensual pleasures. And maybe I should read that sutta out actually on one of these retreats, because it is a really, it's quite a nice sutta. And in there, he explains this simile in much more detail. It's useful to just to do that, just to remind ourselves of what this really is about, why it works, because it is so counterintuitive. What do you mean sensual pleasures are like a charcoal pit? Charcoal pit is entirely unpleasant, entirely problematic. How can sensual pleasures be like that? And of course the point is, it is viewed from a higher viewpoint, and that is why it is possible to see it in this way. It is viewed from the viewpoint of an arahant who is no longer any interest there, and that is when this starts to become reasonable. But for the rest, it is actually hard to see here. So what the Buddha says in this Magandhya Sutta, he's speaking to this wanderer called Magandhya, and he is a wanderer who enjoys sensual pleasures. In India they had all kinds of people, all kinds of wanderers, and they still have that to the present day, all kinds of people doing all kinds of amazing stuff. This is what makes India such an interesting country. It's a very spiritual place, and all these people trying to find a way. Sometimes they use the wrong means to find the way, but it's still kind of very interesting to see that eagerness in the pursuit of the spiritual path. Indian society is kind of special like that. There's nowhere else on earth, I think, quite like that. I've been there, I've seen some of these things. It's kind of awesome to see here. Anyway, so he speaks to this Magandhya, and he's one of these wanderers, and he's a wanderer who enjoys sensual pleasures. Again, it seems like counter to the spiritual path to enjoy sensual pleasures. But again, India had everything here. So he says to the Buddha, this is the highest happiness, yeah, this body enjoying sensual pleasures, yeah, this is it, this is kind of nirvana or whatever, kind of a very low form of nirvana or nibbana, but anyway. So the Buddha says to him, I will give you a simile here, the simile of the charcoal pit. Suppose there was a man who was a leper, and because he was a leper has all these sores on their hands and their feet. And on these sores, often they become incredibly itchy. Sometimes there is maggots and things crawling in these sores because they are just really, really disgusting and very, very itchy. And that leper, he goes to a charcoal pit and he burns his hands over the charcoal pit because the itchiness is so bad, that heat and that burning of the hand actually feels pleasurable to that leper. Yeah, he gets rid of some of that itchiness, at least for a short time, until he comes back again. Then he has to go back to a charcoal pit later on. So then the Buddha says, suppose that leper who was burning his hands in this way over the charcoal pit, suppose he found a doctor, and this doctor was able to cure him of the leprosy. What do you think, Magandhya? After he was cured from leprosy, would that man still go back to that charcoal pit and burn his hands over that charcoal pit? And Magandhya said, of course not. The reason is because before, his faculties were distorted. That charcoal pit was just as hot before as it is now. But because his faculties were distorted, what actually was painful felt as if it was pleasant. And this is exactly the thing with sensual pleasures. Maybe not all sensual pleasures, but it is certainly the case sometimes with sensual pleasures that they are experienced as happiness, when in fact, underlying there actually is a problem, there actually is an experience of pain. That is kind of astonishing. How can we make sense of this? And there is a number of ways of making sense of this in a kind of more ordinary way. And one of them, one way to make sense of this is the idea of smoking cigarettes. Yeah, I don't know if you ever tried to smoke a cigarette. I don't know, I've tried a few times, and I remember as a young man I was kind of coughing and really terrible. Yeah, you smoke the cigarettes and you think you're going to be really cool or whatever. There's always a desire to be cool when you're young. Did you have that desire? I don't know. I had that desire to be really cool when I was younger. So you had this desire to be cool. You had to be one of the boys. Yeah? You had to kind of really do the right thing and all that kind of stuff. So you smoke these things, and it's terrible. You're coughing and spluttering away, and you try to hide it so you don't cough too much. It's embarrassing to cough, yeah? You're supposed to be cool. You can't cough too much to be when you're cool. So, and it's just terrible. But then what happens is that if you... I never smoked much. I never became addicted to smoking. I didn't have that problem. And especially when you smoke big cigars, yeah? At my university, we smoked... We went to these parties, had tuxedos, because it was kind of an old-fashioned university, been around for a long time, so we wore the same thing that people wore 100 years ago. And you smoked big cigars, and you kind of really... This was kind of what life was like at this university. It's really, really nuts when you think that back at those things. And then you get addicted to the smoking here. And once you are addicted to the smoking here, that same cigarette, that same cigar, that same pipe. I was talking with Nicholas the other day about musing. Musing is one of the words that is used by the early translators to translate jhana. Musing means like you think or contemplate, yeah? It's like what the Victorian gentlemen in England, they would have the pipe and they would sit in front of the fireplace in the armchair and they would muse. And that is how they translated jhana, yeah? It's kind of nuts. Complete misunderstanding of what is going on. So again, same thing. And you smoke your pipe, yeah, and you get so addicted to this. And because you are so incredibly addicted, the craving is so incredibly powerful. So actually, what the pleasure that you have when you take a cigarette or you smoke your pipe or whatever it is. The pleasure is actually the reduction in craving. The taste of the thing is equally terrible as it was before. It is still, it's just that you are habituated to it, but you're letting go of the craving. And that is the pleasure. So that is the whole pleasure. Yeah, it's just like this leper over the fire burning his fingers. It is pleasurable because the craving is disappearing. In the same way, you smoke that cigarette so you can get rid of the craving. So you create an artificial craving by getting addicted to cigarettes, and then you enjoy that getting rid of that craving afterwards. When you think about it, it's complete nuts. Yeah, it's completely crazy. You're creating this artificial problem in you, and then you overcome that problem by smoking these cigarettes that are so bad for your health anyway. The whole thing is just completely nonsense. And all it does is just lead to suffering, it leads to craving, it leads to you running around, leads to restlessness, it leads to problem. And of course, there is no solution there, because the craving always returns afterwards, always. And there's always another cigarette later on, and always moving on in that way. And I think one of the main references that this simile of the charcoal pit is about, I think one of the main references is to sexual pleasures. Because they are a bit like a very powerful addiction. That is often where the craving can be the most powerful. Yeah, and one of the things that is interesting about this, and this was Ajahn Brahm pointed this out to me a while ago, is that they had measured some people, the brain activity, while they were engaging in some kind of sexual activity. And what they found out was that actually it was the, in part at least, it was the pain center of the brain that lit up. Exactly what the Buddha was talking about. But now you had a kind of an MRI scanner to prove the point. Yeah, and there it was. The pain center was lighting up. So again, the same kind of idea. Things that may seem incredibly pleasurable to us, and there may also be a pleasurable component there, but a large part of that actually is a painful component. The overcoming of the craving, and it's actually that overcoming of the craving that is the pleasure, and there isn't that much pleasure beside. And afterwards, after you kind of have indulged in your sensual pleasures, you feel kind of empty. It's all gone. There's nothing really there anymore. And it's kind of an empty dullness or even depression that comes afterwards. Because actually, you have overcome the suffering, you have overcome the craving. And then the problem has kind of been resolved and there's nothing left. And kind of it's all pointless and aimless. So I think this is possibly the way to understand this. And then you can maybe get your head around what is going on. And seen from the higher viewpoint of the Buddha, it starts to make sense once you start to think about these things a bit more carefully. But it is a very radical simile because it seems so incredibly counterintuitive to how we normally think about these things. Okay, let us go on to the next one here. Householder, suppose a man dreamt about lovely parks, lovely groves, lovely meadows, and lovely lakes, and on waking he saw nothing of it. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a dream by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. Yeah. And this one, I think, is quite easy to relate to. How often we think about sensual pleasures in the future, how we crave for them, how we kind of think about what they will be like. And we have this idea of, and we forget about the downside always, the dream of what the world is going to be like in the future, how we're going to enjoy all our possessions and all the things around us. And when we wake up, when we finally get there, we move in that direction, it is nothing really like it. And I always like to think about my own life and how I also had those dreams when I was young. You go to university, you have a dream about what kind of girlfriend you're going to have, what kind of job you're going to have, and what kind of wonderful career you're going to have. When you're young, you're really conceited. You think you're going to have this really amazing career, whatever it is. And you have all these ideas about what kind of shape your life is going to take. And then you end up like this, yeah? And you see how you wasted your time completely with those dreams. You ended up in a completely different place than where you started out. So the dreams are always false. They're always empty. Everything seems so much greener, yeah, when in the dream. The grass on the other side of the fence is always greener than this side. The reality is often so different from the dream. So catch yourself when you think about the future. Catch yourself when you think about how nice things are going to be. That holiday, that relationship, that sensual pleasure, whatever it is. And ask yourself whether it really is the case. What does history, what does your life experience tell you about these pleasures of the world? And very quickly you will see that it is always overblown. It never really turns out the way it is supposed to turn out. One of the other suttas, actually it's getting, time is going, I'll maybe talk about that later on if I can. It's quite a nice little sutta, but I think I'll leave it out for now because we only got a few minutes left. I want to finish off this sutta also. I'm sure you can relate to this to some extent, the idea how the future always seems much brighter than it ever really turns out. It always turns out to be much more ordinary and common than you think it's going to be. Let's go on to the next one. Householder, suppose a man borrowed goods on loan, a fancy carriage, fine jeweled earrings, and preceded and surrounded by those borrowed goods, he went to the marketplace. Then people seeing him would say, "Sirs, that is a rich man. That is how the rich enjoy their wealth." Then the owners, whenever they saw him, would take back their things. What do you think, householder? Would that be enough for that man to become dejected? Yes, venerable sir, why is that? Because the owners took back their things. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers us. Sensual pleasures have been compared to borrowed goods by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So here you borrow stuff. Yeah, that doesn't sound all that interesting, fancy carriage and fine jeweled earrings, but anyway, I guess in those that was kind of considered something special. But it's not just that you borrow them, but it is that when you go into the city, other people think you are something special because you have those things. And of course, because other people think you are special, you start to attach this to these things, you start to identify with it. You become those goods. That becomes part of who you are. Your identity is attached to those things. Just like any other attachment, it always is related somehow to your sense of self and your identity. And that is why it is so difficult when the owners come and they take back those borrowed goods, why it is so hard to give it up, precisely because you have attached, because you identify with those things. And afterwards, you know, people will say, "Yeah, now you're poor again. We're not interested in you now. We don't interest in poor people. We only want to be around rich people. Rich people is what is interesting here." That's how the world is sometimes. Yeah, the world is stupid. The world has no sense for what is really valuable. This is this beautiful simile for life, because everything in the sensory world, almost everything that we attach to, all of them are really borrowed goods. You have them for a while and then you have to give them up. Relationships last for a while and then they break up, or you die, or whatever happens. Everything in life, everything in the sensory realm is like that. When you die, you stand pretty much naked. There's not much left. The only thing that you carry with you into the future is that mind that you have built up, the good qualities inside of you that you have transformed yourself into over a long life. That is all that you are left with when you die. And the idea of the death contemplation, like the one I tried to do yesterday, is to give you a feeling for that. Are you ready? Are you able to give up these things? And if you are able to do a death contemplation like that or similar, and you kind of empty all of these things out, you start to see and feel what remains. There's not much. Yeah, there's not much left. You start to realize how much of your identity is directly related to this world, to the people around you, to your social standing, to your education level, to the things that you own, to your family members, to your national background, to all of these things that we identify with. That is what pretty much makes us who we are. Empty that out, and actually it is an incredibly liberating and beautiful experience. Not only is it liberating and beautiful, but it means that when you come to your deathbed, when you're finally going to have to die, and it's not that far away, it happens so fast. Yeah, I look at my own life and see how quickly it has kind of gone by, just like that. It was like, you know, it's just amazing. Hopefully I still have a few years left, but I don't know, I could die tomorrow, who knows what's going to happen. Because of that, when you come to your deathbed, because you have actually understood this, and you have thrown out those things, and you know how to die in the right way, you're able to die in a peaceful way. Instead of being attached to all of these things in this world, you can let it go, and you can allow it to be here. And then you can die in a very positive way, with a positive mind state, feeling happy about the good qualities in your heart, and carry that with you into the future. So remember the idea of the simile of the borrowed goods. It's a bit like the difference between renting a car and owning a car. What is the difference in feeling? It's quite a big difference. Yeah, if you rent a car, you don't kind of attach to it. Yeah, you don't hold on to it in the same way. You don't kind of look after it because you are a good person. So you look after the goods of other people. You don't mistreat it simply because it isn't yours. You treat it well, but you don't kind of get overly obsessed with it. And when you give it up, it is easy to give up. And that is quite a big contrast to how you look after your own car. You're far more fussy about it, to get it right, to be just the right kind of, when you buy it, you look very carefully what kind of color it's going to be, and what kind of, all the kind of extra equipment you want to have or whatnot. All of these things, because it is yours, it's going to be satisfying for you. So if you start to look at life in general like that, everything is just borrowed. Your relationships are borrowed, your body is borrowed. How much time are you going to spend in the gym looking after your body to make it look just right? It's kind of nuts, yeah? The body is going to end up in a small pile of ashes. That's going to be here. All of that hard work that you put into the gym is just returned to nothing. All that is left is just the remnants that come out of the furnace after burning it up at Karakata or Fremantle. That is all that's left of those beautiful muscles that you built up in that gym before. Yeah, it's a waste of time. Yeah, it is not really. Of course, you look after yourself. You make sure that you are reasonably healthy. That is important, because otherwise you can't practice properly. But you don't overdo it. You don't become obsessed with all of these external things that really have no long-term lasting value. And then you focus on the inner beauty instead. It's a very useful perception, because it reminds you of the downside of the external world, the problem with all the things in the external world. And as you do that, you're able to let go of those things. So try to see if you can make sense of the simile of the borrowed goods. And remember, the goods that are not borrowed is the mind that you develop in this life. Why? Because take it with you after you die, also into the future, often from life to life, a long time into the future. So that is the simile of the borrowed goods. There is one simile left, and Maybe I will just leave it out because it's already, we've been going for an hour. If we go too long, after a while it just becomes perhaps too much. So I'll do that later on this afternoon, or maybe this evening instead. So that is all for now. So please keep on enjoying yourself, have a nice lunch, and we'll see you back again at 3 p.m. this afternoon.